Today at Reader's Corner, Christine Bader, author of The Evolution of a Corporate Idealist, When Girl Meets Oil.
So I think a lot of companies have realized that if they don't pay attention to local community needs, I think when things go wrong, it's really hard to fix them. It's really hard to win back trust. A lot of people assume that big companies have a lot of power and that they can just tell the government what to do. And I saw firsthand that that's not really the case. Can a company with 100,000 people spread out over 100 countries have one single unifying culture?
I'm Bob Kustra, president of Boise State University. Welcome to Reader's Corner. When an oil rig explodes, a factory building collapses, or a water supply is tainted, the finger-pointing often starts and stops with the multinational corporation behind the operation. Over the years, big business has been implicated in a plethora of scandals and accidents that have cost lives and damaged the environment. We tend to think of these corporations as monolithic entities that march in lockstep and have singular goals. But as today's guest points out, that's hardly the case. In every major company are women and men who are pushing hard for more responsible practices, and while their work often is invisible, it is making a difference. In her book, The Evolution of a Corporate Idealist, When Girl Meets Oil, Christine Bader recounts her 9 years working for the energy giant BP, as well as her subsequent work at the United Nations. She had left BP by the time a company oil rig exploded in the Gulf of Mexico in 2010, killing 11 workers and causing the largest offshore oil spill in U.S. history. But the disaster still sent her reeling as she wondered if she had severely misjudged the company she had loved working for. Today we're featuring an encore edition of our interview with Christine Bader. She is a lecturer and visiting scholar at Columbia University and an advisor to BSR, the Global Business Network focused on sustainability. She joins us by phone from New York for this interview. Christine Bader, welcome to Reader's Corner.
Thank you so much for having me on.
So, Christine, did you misjudge BP?
That's it. Cut right to the chase, Bob. I like it. You know, I came out of business school, and I was so idealistic and convinced that business could change the world for the better, and I could make that happen. And at the time when I joined in 2000, BP was run by John Brown, and Brown had recently become the first head of a big energy company to acknowledge the realities of climate change and urge action. And I joined the company, and I really saw those aspirations come to life. I worked on these incredibly complex projects in Indonesia and in China, where it was pretty clear that the social and environmental and community sensitivities could actually make or break these projects. So I had full license to, you know, invest, to consult with communities, to bring in experts, and I really saw that come to life there.
So let's talk about the Indonesian experience. You're a newly minted MBA, and you're sent to Indonesia. That in itself is quite a chore. Tell us what happens when you get there and what you're supposed to do there.
Sure. Yeah, you bet. Well, I got there not long after BP had taken over ARCO, the American oil company. And a lot of the assets that BP had acquired with that takeover were in Indonesia. So I went out there, and I was supposed to be a commercial analyst, Bob, using my brand new MBA Excel skills. So I was crunching data. I was crunching financial and production data to try to help the company figure out which of those assets BP should keep, what should it spin off, what should it do with all this stuff. You know, at the time, corporate social responsibility and sustainability weren't really on the lips of every CEO like it is today. There weren't really jobs in this field, but I went out there because it was an interesting place, and there was an important job to do. So I was doing that, but then there was one project in particular that was proving really interesting. And from a technical, from a financial point of view, the project was totally straightforward. It was a big liquefied natural gas facility that BP was going to build. And BP's done that all over the world, but never in a place like West Papua. It's at the remote eastern tip of Indonesia. It has so many flora and fauna species that don't exist anywhere else in the world. There's not a lot of human settlement there. There is one village of 127 households that were going to have to move to make way for the facility. So we were going to have to undertake this resettlement. We were going to have to work with the Indonesian military, which is not known for their good community relations. there's a lot of corruption in Indonesia. So it just became clear the more we looked at this project, the more we thought, oh my goodness, we need some more people to focus full time on these issues. And again, we didn't have an army of corporate responsibility professionals to deploy. I just put my hand up and said, whatever that is, I want to work on that.
Mm-hmm. Now, tell us about the energy source itself, this liquefied gas. Where was this gas going once it was produced?
So the project itself was a gas field in a bay, so a nice, big, fat, juicy gas field that sat really close to the surface, so pretty easy to develop. BP was going to build a short underwater pipeline to an onshore processing plant that would compress the gas so that it could be loaded up onto tankers that would take the gas and ship it out all over the Pacific Rim, basically. So mostly around Asia, but potentially to California as well.
The reason I ask the question is because, of course, you mentioned there's a small village nearby, and I'd like you to address the so-called resource curse that you mentioned at in the beginning of your book.
Sure. So the resource curse, unfortunately, is a phenomenon that's happened all over the world that shows that communities where natural resources are discovered, ironically and tragically, end up worse off than they were before. You know, people get really excited when somebody discovers oil or gas or minerals nearby, thinking this is great, it's going to bring us wealth and riches. And unfortunately, the people living nearby often end up with just more poverty and corruption and pollution and don't see the benefits, either because the national government, unfortunately, in many places is corrupt and strikes a deal with the company and puts the money in their pockets. It doesn't end up trickling back to the people who are living closest to the resource. And frankly, a lot of companies over time have made it worse by thinking that all they need to do is strike a deal with the national government. They don't need to worry about local communities. They can just put up a big fence or a big wall and just, you know, throw some philanthropic dollars over the fence once in a while, right? But what's that expression, Bob? Show me a 10-foot fence and I'll show you an 11-foot ladder.
That's right.
Right? So I think a lot of companies have realized that doesn't work anymore, that if they don't pay attention to local community needs, they're going to have to spend a lot more money later on security, on community relations. And more importantly, I think when things go wrong, it's really hard to fix them. It's really hard to win back trust. So we knew all of that going into this project in Indonesia and really wanted to try to see if we could do something differently.
And in this case, doing it differently was resettling the villagers to another location.
Well, it was, but the part that was different was that we brought in the World Bank's top resettlement expert, literally the guy who wrote the book on resettlement for the World Bank, to advise us. I mean, Bob, resettlement happens all over the place, right? I mean, all over the world for dams. I mean, here in New York, we're building the Second Avenue subway, and people had to resettle for that. But there's a process, right? When people have to move, they are consulted so that they understand what their options are. If need be, they are compensated, you know, if their livelihoods are impacted. And the problem was that for this project, the community had been told that they were going to have to move, but there was no good documentation of the process. It wasn't clear that they understood what was going to happen with them, what their options were. So we wanted to start over again and again bring in some of the world's top experts who could make sure that we were doing this to international standards, which was beyond national law.
And somewhere during your time there, there was also an assassination of someone, a leader in the movement for Papuan independence. And you had an interesting insight into how, I guess, things really work in these countries when the company wanted at least to know, you know, how do you get to the bottom of this? How do you find out who did this and the country's action was?
Yeah, Bob, that was intense. I mean, what's so interesting is that a lot of people assume that big companies have a lot of power and that they can just tell the government what to do. And I saw firsthand that that's not really the case. Certainly, there are plenty of situations where companies do have a lot of influence. But in that situation, when it came to the Indonesian military, we could not tell anybody what to do. And the danger, of course, was that the Indonesian military, unfortunately, has a proven track record of human rights abuses. And in fact, the same commander who we were going to be working with around that project was named by the East Timor Truth and Reconciliation Commission for overseeing human rights abuses there. And as you say, one of the leaders, there had always there had been a longstanding separatist movement in that province, and the leader of that movement, one of the leaders, was assassinated and widely presumed to be the Indonesian military. So we met with the commander privately and, you know, exchanged some pleasantries, and then one of my colleagues took a deep breath and said, "We want you to know that this case is causing great concern back home in London, where our headquarters are, and even in Washington, D.C., and people want to know if BP can operate in a place where such a case cannot be brought to justice. So we just want to express our wishes that this case will be resolved." And this guy, the general whom we were meeting with, was, you know, a pretty scary dude, Bob. I mean, he had his sunglasses on the whole time. And all the while, he'd been speaking through a translator. He said in halting English when we showed up that he apologized that his English was not very good and so continued to speak through the translator. And then when my colleague said this, the translator's jaw dropped. And then he started to speak, and the general put his hand up and said, "This will be like the assassination of your JFK. No one will ever know what happened."
And that pretty much sums it up. You're listening to Christine Bader. She's the author of The Evolution of a Corporate Idealist, When Girl Meets Oil. Meanwhile, on the other side of the equation, you have a human rights impact assessment that is submitted, but doesn't really wind up where it should eventually go. And that's really the legal department, I guess. Is that right?
Yeah, that was an interesting exercise. I mean, that came about because many projects around the world that have a big physical footprint, they're required to do an environmental impact assessment, usually by the government. Increasingly, they have to incorporate social issues, so they might be an environmental and social impact assessment. And we were doing one of those for that Indonesia project, but it was clear that that study was more about micro and direct impact. So, you know, how many people are going to be employed by the plant? How is the air quality going to change and the water quality? But it wasn't getting at some of these larger human rights issues like our relationship with the military. So, again, we brought in two human rights experts to do this assessment for us, to interview lots of different stakeholders and give us their recommendations on what we maybe wanted to do to mitigate the risks to the local residents and to the company. And so, as you say, they submitted this report and, you know, interviewed a lot of people for it. And I assumed that we would publish the report in full. I assumed that that was part of the point of it. So I was getting ready to do that, and then I got a call from our legal department that said, "What do you mean you want to publish this?" And I said, "Well, wasn't that the point of doing it?" And they said, "But this says bad things about the Indonesian military." I said, "What, is this a surprise that they've been implicated in human rights abuses?" And they said, "Well, it's got our name on it. It could be considered libelous, and we certainly don't want to antagonize them." And I could understand that, you know, having met with some of these guys. So we came up with a compromise that we would publish a summary, which, you know, was not wholly satisfying to me. But I think the fact that we had commissioned this assessment, that we were able to release a summary, I think this was the first time that a project like that for a company had ever commissioned a human rights impact assessment, which is now becoming more common practice. So I had to be satisfied that, I might have lost that skirmish, but I was making progress anyway.
So you mentioned earlier, on the lips of every CEO today, this corporate social responsibility, sustainability. I'd like to explore that a little bit, because it seems to me that the great challenge the corporate idealist has is getting into the flow of authority in the organization. Who are CEOs? Well, a good number of them are CFOs before they're CEOs. Mm-hmm. And the CFO is a bottom line kind of a guy or a gal. and interested in, you know, taking care of that shareholder. And when you start throwing these ideas of spending more money on sustainability or social responsibility, so often it seems they're rebuffed. And I just like your comparison. It's 2014 now. How far have we come in engaging the CEO, if not the CFO, in truly believing and understanding and operating according to sustainability?
Yeah, this is a really important question, Bob, and I think it depends on the industry. So I think that a lot of mining companies and oil and gas companies get this, because there have been so many examples around the world where a company has not paid attention to sustainability and however you want to define that, or corporate responsibility, and it's cost them a lot of money. So I realize now in retrospect, part of why I had so much freedom and license and budget to do what I did in Indonesia was that there were some terrible examples nearby of where things had gone horribly wrong, causing harm to people and costing the company a lot of money. I mean, in that same province as that first project I worked on in Indonesia was Freeport-McMoRan's Grasberg Copper and Gold Mine. It's one of the largest in the world. And they've had to spend something like $26 million a year just on security, just on that mine, because community relationships have gotten so bad there. And, you know, that's a lot of money. At the other end of the country, in Aceh, ExxonMobil had a similar facility to the one we were building there, a liquefied natural gas plant. And they had to shut down for 4 months in 2001 because of basically a civil war going on around them that some people accused the company of exacerbating. And that shutdown cost that company hundreds of millions of dollars. And, you know, even for ExxonMobil, I mean, that's a lot of money.
Exactly.
So that's the kind of thing that really does get a CFO and a CEO's attention. So I think there are some industries that really get it. And then, as we've seen tragically in Bangladesh with the Rana Plaza factory collapse there, which is not the first tragedy there, that has really caused a lot of the apparel companies to take a big hit to their brand, first of all. I mean, who wants people protesting their stores and boycotting their brands? But also, you know, in every company's best interest is business continuity, right? And ensuring that they can get the quality of product that they need. And so, frankly, if a company is not meeting standards on treating its workers right, they're probably not meeting standards in other areas as well. So I think there are some industries that are starting to get it, but we've got a long way to go.
One of the things I found interesting about your analysis and insights into BP was the time you were working in London when there was the Texas City explosion in America, where in 2005 at BP's Texas City refinery, about 15 people were killed outside of Galveston. And yet you were over in London and were surprised and embarrassed to hear that. And I guess it brings up this whole issue of how do you take a corporate culture and change it to the point where no matter where it is and no matter how far flung it is, there is this deep understanding of the importance of safety, of human rights. Apparently BP didn't get that right. And you have to wonder, when these companies get so large, if anybody can get it right.
Bob, if I had the answer to that question, you know, I'd have the key to the universe
right here.
I mean, this is really the question, isn't it? It's, can a company with 100,000 people spread out over 100 countries have one single unifying culture? And I honestly don't know the answer to that. I mean, my experience with BP was that I was working with all these people who really seemed to get it, right? Who got how important human rights and the environment were to the success of the business. And I now realize, looking back, that that was actually not the case throughout the company. But I don't know how you change that. I mean, I've never worked for ExxonMobil, but my impression of that company is that, you know, there's a manual, right? And everybody gets the manual. And it's a very kind of, again, this is just my impression from the outside, it's a very kind of hierarchical command and control kind of place. I mean, actually, when I was graduating from business school, I joined BP, and one of my classmates joined ExxonMobil, and he was in the military. And 5 years later, at our five-year MBA reunion, we were two of the few people who were still at the same companies.
Oh, interesting.
That we had joined. Yeah, which is interesting. And I think, you know, he really fit in with the culture there, and that would not have worked for me. And I really liked the culture of BP, which was much more, it was also much more European and much less American in a way. It was much more about values and people driven by values rather than driven by a manual and fear of litigation, which seems to dominate American companies.
Mm-hmm.
But it's interesting, and I don't know, I mean, not everybody would thrive in that kind of, you know, hierarchical command and control, very strict kind of environment. But maybe there are some kinds of situations in industries where that is called for. I don't know the answer to that, Bob, but that's one of the reasons that, you know, I felt compelled to write the book, was at least to explore this question.
Today we're having a conversation with Christine Bader, author of The Evolution of a Corporate Idealist, When Girl Meets Oil. Well, even in my little world of trying to keep track of a university, when people ask me, you know, what do you do? I say I drill down, and I forgive the metaphor coming from your former company and industry. But you have to drill down constantly, but it's a lot easier to drill down when you have a 160-acre campus and a handful of buildings than something that's far-flung across the planet. You know, you mentioned these in your book, you mentioned these production sharing agreements. I'm fascinated by those because for those of us who think that, oh, these oil companies own all this land and they just go in and do what they want to do on their property, they go into these other countries. As you mentioned, in Indonesia, it's government land. And these production sharing agreements are entered into by the company and the government. And I would assume in countries like Indonesia and your China experience, that's where the rubber meets the road. That must be where the company either has or does not have the opportunity to exert the kinds of practices that you, the corporate idealist, would like.
Yes, that is a really good point. I mean, in a lot of countries, like in Indonesia, the national government owns the resources. And a company like BP is basically like a contractor to the government, right? The government puts out a bid for a company to develop that resource, and that's what they're hired to do. They're not given it.
Right.
So they could, you know, in theory, be fired by the government if the government doesn't like what they're doing. In China, I had a slightly different experience, which was that it was a 50-50 joint venture between BP and Sinopec, one of China's state energy companies. And so there, the government was also our business partner. So obviously, that was a very sensitive project. And one where it was a really, I mean, it was a tough conversation, Bob. I'll share with you a story. When I first got there, my first week there, we were running down a spreadsheet with the latest estimates for the cost and the timeline for the project. We were building a big chemicals plant that was going to bring in a construction workforce that would peak at about 15,000 migrant workers in a town of about 30,000 people. So my first week there, we're going down this spreadsheet, and the whole thing hadn't yet been translated into English. So we're going down the sheet, and there's a number 8, and the label was still in Mandarin. And my BP colleague asked the Sinopec colleague, what's that? What's the number 8? And the Sinopec manager said, that's the projected number of fatalities. And my BP colleague said, excuse me? And he said, yeah, based on a project this big, this many man hours, we'd expect about 8 fatalities. And my colleague said, the target is not 8. The target is 0. And the Sinopec manager looked kind of perplexed, and he said, well, that's not realistic. And I barreled in there saying, okay, we're going to protect the human rights of workers and communities. And, you know, that kind of fell flat. I mean, I didn't get thrown out or anything, but people just sort of looked at me blankly. And then I tried, well, these are the standards that BP uses around the world, and so we're going to use them here. And, you know, that just sounded really arrogant. So finally I had to shut up for a while and listen to what resonated with people and what motivated them and what drove them. So finally, when I was able to come back with, okay, these are the standards that world-class model projects use. I understand that you want this to be a world-class model project, so these are the standards that we'll use here for working hours, for the dormitories, for the migrant workers. And they were like, oh, okay, why didn't you say so?
Huh.
I mean, I'm being a little bit flippant, but,
sure.
But you
right.
get the idea.
Yeah. So I have to ask one final selfish question on behalf of
sure.
my students. So yeah. many students I run into, and our undergraduates, will say, what are you going to do with your lives? Oh, international business. And I often wonder if they really know what that means. That is, where they'll be and what they'll be doing. You are living proof of a student who wound up in international business. What would you tell a student who's an undergraduate as to how to prepare, how to prepare for the career you have had, very successful career you've had?
Well, thank you, Bob. I'm glad you asked this question because it really is a big part of why I wrote the book, because I get so many inquiries from people saying, you know, I really want to get into this field and how do I do it? And there's always this question that sits just beneath the surface of what will it really be like? And people want to know, you know, can I really live out my values if I join a big company? Or do I have to check them at the door? And I wrote this book to show people what life will be like inside a big company. So although BP did break my heart with the Deepwater Horizon disaster and this very different BP that emerged in the aftermath, and I went through this whole journey of really questioning, had I really learned anything about business at all? But then realizing that the work is incremental, that I did really have an impact on the workers and communities living around the projects that I did work on, and that really matters. But this is hard. This is hard work. But I think it's really important, Bob. I think there are a few things more important than getting some of our brightest and most passionate young people deep inside big corporations, because everybody thinks it's sexy to start up their own social entrepreneurial venture. But I really think we need people deep inside big companies. But the choice of where to work is deeply personal. We're all going to thrive in different environments. So people ask me, well, should I go work at Amnesty International or should I go work at the UN or should I go work at Shell? And we're all going to thrive in different environments, and that can change over time. And that's okay. You know, some of the people I interviewed for my book worked in a big company for a while and said, forget it, I'm going to leave and I'm going to go work at Amnesty International, and there I'm going to spin my wheels a different way because every job has its ups and downs. Don't be fooled. But I think it's really, really important to have people working deep inside big companies. So the skills that I think that people need to do this job well are, frankly, Bob, the skills that they're going to need in any job. So people need to learn to listen really hard. People need to be able to communicate, whether that's in writing or in the spoken word, and one-on-one and in groups and understanding cross-cultural dynamics. I found that that was probably the most important part of my work. In addition to obviously having great technical competency, having financial literacy, but spreadsheets are important, but they're only one piece of the job. So I hope that a lot of your students do go into international business, Bob, but I hope that they recognize how important sustainability is to whatever they're going to do in their lives.
Well stated, Christine. Thank you so much. Christine Bader, thanks for joining us today at Reader's Corner.
Thank you, Bob.
I hope you enjoyed this encore edition of our interview with Christine Bader. Next week, Jacob Soule, author of The Reckoning, Financial Accountability and the Rise and Fall of Nations. The engineer for today's show is Eric Jones. Research and production by Janelle Brown. I'm Bob Kuspra. Please join me next week as we talk to today's leading writers about the ideas and issues that help shape our world at Reader's Corner. To listen to recent interviews anytime, download our free player from the iTunes App Store. Find it by searching for Reader's Corner.